Welcome to the second and final part of a program we're calling Making Votes Matter. In this segment, we'll discuss single-party voting, political polls, and methods of setting election district boundaries, especially those meant to favor a particular political party. More on Making Votes Matter just ahead on Media Meet. Welcome to part two of Making Votes Matter on WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are Marquette County Clerk Linda Talsma, Marquette City Clerk Chris Hazarus, and Northern Michigan University Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Administration Robert Kulishek. We've been talking about the Promote the Vote ballot measure, which includes no excuse absentee voting and same-day registration. We've talked about those. The final measure would guarantee the right of any eligible resident to vote a straight party ticket with only one mark on the ballot. We can't vote a straight party ticket now?
Actually, we never have been able to in a primary election. So in August,
okay,
you can't do a crossover vote. You can in November in the general.
I see.
Did you want to add anything?
Anything
to that,
you'd like
Chris?
To add?
A part of the confusion is in January of 2016, Governor Snyder signed off that we could not have the straight party, and then that was challenged.
I see.
So that's still in the works. That went on hold July 2016. So for August and November, we still had straight party votes.
All right.
There's a great example of straight party votes.
Okay.
So we really have, part of the confusion might be just splitting a ticket in a primary, and people do get that confused, that you can't split your ticket.
Go ahead.
Straight ticket voting is an issue that some people are in favor of, some are opposed to. Oftentimes it relates to whose ox is being gored, so to speak, partisan-wise. I think Democrats think that they will benefit more having straight party ticket voting. Republicans think they will benefit less. So it kind of breaks out that way.
And is that generally assumed?
That's generally assumed, and it's usually assumed that Republicans are a little more high education level, a little more affluent, a little more likely to come in and vote on all of the specific issues. But there are other arguments that can be brought to bear on this as well. And one is ease of voting and length of time that people have to wait in line. And in a presidential election, and if you have a lot of things on the ballot, and if you can't straight party vote, as many people do, it will increase the length of time people have to wait to vote. Another factor is it's difficult to make decisions. You think about Michigan, you know, how much time have you really given to the various candidates on the Board of Regents for Wayne State University, which is a partisan vote? I mean, that is something that you probably are going to straight ticket vote one way or the other on that. So I think straight ticket voting is a tradition in Michigan in the general election. We've had it for years. People seem to want it. The governor has said no. I think that's another reason why it's on the laundry list of things on the Promote the Vote as something they would like to preserve. And it's done in some states and not done in others. But here there's the tradition.
Okay.
Bob, you brought up a good point with not knowing the individuals on the ballot. I just want to slide in, when you view your ballot online, okay, you can go ahead and if it's highlighted in blue, you can click on that candidate. It takes you right to their website. I'm not saying all of them have that, but it's one way to make a decision,
and
you get some background on that individual. And you are right. I mean, the Board of Regents, those ones you usually don't know. But they do have websites out there, so I think it's great to know.
The premise in this proposed constitutional amendment to Promote the Vote is that the more ways one can vote, the more votes will be cast. That seems to be an implicit premise. It seems reasonable, but it doesn't necessarily follow, depending on you know, people, how people identify themselves. The Secretary of State says Michigan already saw a record number of registered voters in 2016, with near-record turnouts in recent elections. So any observations on the premise? Do we need it in order to get the vote out?
Well, if you compare the United States with other countries, Western European countries, for example, our voter turnout is significantly lower than most of these other countries. If the assumption is that we want more people to vote, to feel vested in democracy, I think even if we can increase voter turnout beyond what it's been, even if it's a little bit higher, that's to our advantage. Which also goes to another point that there has been, over the past year or two, I think, more and more cynicism that's developing among the American public with regard to the viability of our democracy and whether votes really count. And I think it's important for people to truly believe, and for it to be true, that their vote does count. And one way that people demonstrate a commitment to the system and a belief in the system is through voting. And if they're discouraged from voting, it leads to apathy and cynicism, and that's not good.
Okay. What about practical problems that people who don't run elections may not see? Would any of these proposals increase costs or put a special burden on local units of government, as far as you can tell?
Well, I don't think cost is really that big of an issue,
okay,
because I don't want to put a cost burden out there as a problem. But, however, what I do see is the local clerks need to be able to have time to make their paperwork happen. And when you're getting into this thing with the same-day voting, that's a hard situation. So Chris might want to elaborate on that a little bit as she's taking them in.
Sure.
It would be a time factor. Two things. Because we use an electronic poll book, when we download off the system, off the state system, everybody that meets that registration deadline goes into our poll book. If we were to have somebody come into the precinct and say, well, I want to register to vote and vote today, we would have to hold up that line, get all this voter's information, enter it into our poll book, then be able to issue them a ballot on the spot, and then go back to my office and register them in the system and update them there, because the two mesh at the end of the day. When you go in to vote, you have a voter history. Mm-hmm. This system doesn't show how you voted, it just shows that you voted.
That you voted. Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of a fly in the ointment kind of thing for my staff, because it would hold up voter lines depending on the, you know, interest of any given election.
On that particular issue.
It seems that the logistics are important and the clerks have to be treated properly in that.
Sure. They're the ones.
And we should work it out so it does work. As was pointed out, the cost shouldn't be the factor. And I was doing some numbers before when we were talking about how much it costs to do elections. And I think probably for every citizen in Marquette County, it's less than $5 a year if you figure out total cost. And you think about that, that's to keep democracy going. I mean, we pay cable bills, we pay parking meters.
Sure.
Is democracy worth $5 a year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, and I think that's why you can't put a cost onto that. I think it's more logistics and making sure everybody's fitting in the right spot, and then we don't have any problems or issues.
I understand. Some critics of the American electoral system see a problem not in vote totals, but in how they're applied. That is, in the method of establishing electoral districts. Voter districts are redrawn every 10 years with the U.S. Census. And this has resulted in some really creative map-making in some cases. Analysts say the system favors winners, especially incumbents. And Dr. Kulishak, what was the original context and intent of that law?
Wow, that's a dangerous question to ask a former government teacher. I mean, you could get a big, long answer. Let me try and be concise about it. The term gerrymandering goes back almost to the beginning of our country. Elbridge Gerry was the person who drew this first thing to look like a salamander, a district line, and they called it a gerrymander. You know, gerrymander became gerrymander. But anyway, the point is that every 10 years after the census, they have to reapportion the legislatures to make sure you have the proper number of people in each of the districts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, That requires then drawing district lines. When you draw district lines, you can do it for partisan advantage. So the party that controls the state legislature in many states, most states, does the drawing of the lines. And oftentimes that leads to a distortion of what the vote turnout would be. Now, for example, in 2010, if you take all of the congressional votes in the United States, the Democrats got 1.2 million more than the Republicans did. Yet the Republicans got a 30-seat majority in the House of Representatives because of the drawing of lines. And you can do this at state level and whatever. And I think that, you know, you can say, well, this is partisan concern. Well, it's partisan, but it cuts both ways, because there's been times when Democrats have controlled it, and they've done it to Republicans. Now, I'm just going one more little bit here, if I may. There are some negative consequences of this beyond simply what I mentioned. And one is the fact that if you have gerrymandering, you have a tendency for the incumbents to protect themselves. In 2010, out of all of the districts in the United States running for Congress, the number of incumbents who lost was two. That tells you how incumbents have been able to protect themselves.
In California, both parties colluded, if you like, in coming up with what was called a bipartisan gerrymander to protect the seats of the incumbents.
Yeah, the incumbents get the advantage. And then another thing, and then I will defer to others. Another thing that happens is the real contest then tends to be in the primary, because you know you're going to win if you get to the general election if your party has did the district.
Get through the primary.
So if the primary is most important, and our clerks here can tell this, primary elections are very low turnout. The people who vote in primary elections are the most extreme people in their parties, their base. Yeah. They then determine who the congressman and senator, or the congressman will be, which means when they get to Congress, they're not going to compromise. And for the rest of us, we wind up with deadlock rather than democracy.
There you go.
So it's a complicated issue.
Sure. In 37 states, including Michigan and Wisconsin, state legislatures have authority in setting district boundaries. In four states, I thought it was more, but in four states, independent commissions are responsible. Two states have political commissions, and seven states have only one district, so there's no need for a commission in that case. Federal guidelines call for fairly simple, relatively equal population distribution with no racial or ethnic discrimination, all right? Yet gerrymandering, setting the boundaries to favor a party or a position, is commonplace when parties have strong majorities. So what happened to create this circumstance that now parties that have, it's so commonplace when parties have strong majorities to gerrymandering going on.
A good explanation for a lot of political behavior is self-interest.
Okay.
They gerrymander because it's in their self-interest, and they can do it.
All right.
And what I think some
No more complicated motive than that.
It's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Now, having said that, then, there are a number of states that are experimenting with different ways to take this away from the legislature and try to find nonpartisan commissions that can do this, or partisan ones that are pitting ambition against ambition. It's not as easy as it seems once you get into it, as if we talk a bit about the voters not politician proposal on the Michigan ballot. There are some where I am strongly in favor of dealing with the problems associated with gerrymandering. There are a number of issues in this ballot proposal that are going to be very difficult to implement.
Yeah. Well, this is, there seems to be a move to do this to such a technical degree now that it's difficult to even follow. I mean, you need Stanford University math skills, you know, sometimes to figure out how they went about doing this. It makes you wonder, could common laws and practices be outdated when simply applying a computer algorithm can take apportionment down to less than a city block, maybe even to a single house on a block? I mean, that technology literally means that the winner simply has to be in charge. You know, if you're in charge, you're probably going to win in the first place, right?
And that's why you need to have some kind of an objective nonpartisan group doing this. But the problem is, how do you select that group? And when we get talking about the voters, not politicians, proposal, we may want to focus in on that particular dimension of the concern.
Okay. We're in part two right now of a program called Making Votes Matter, featuring Marquette County Clerk Linda Talsma, Marquette City Clerk Chris Hazaris, and NMU Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Administration Robert Kulishek. The question seems to become whether, you know, you've got all this detail now, whether or not such detail can even be applied fairly, as these are already formula to try and get to a certain kind of result, right?
Well, let me identify two issues that I think, when the debate takes place with regard to whether this proposal for redistricting in Michigan should go through, which is called Voters, Not Politicians.
Right.
I think the two issues that are going to get the most attention would be, one, how do you select the 13-person commission? And the problem in Michigan is we don't register people by party. So we can't say, well, these are registered Democrats, these are registered Republicans. We would have to say, well, if we're going to have, you know, a third Democrats, a third Republicans, and a third Independents, they're self-identified. Well, a lot of, in one of the things that studies have shown, people who call themselves independent really aren't in the most instances. They're an independent who's never voted for a Democrat or vice versa.
Or a Republican.
Or, you know, or vice versa. Yeah. So it's hard to say who the independents would be, and just how long have they been a Democrat? Are they really a Democrat, or did they just discover now they were? So they're going to have to figure out how they're going to select those people. And then there's some provisions in there about having it roughly balanced by demographics. You know, you should have the proper number of A by age, by gender, by region of the state. And you break it out that way, and you only got 13 people. So how are you going to do all that? So that's a question that needs to be addressed. And then there's some, as you've alluded to already, detailed questions about how you draw the lines, which mean, you know, there's no way that 13 randomly selected people, these are going to be randomly selected, are likely to have the expertise to be able to make this judgment. So they're going to have to hire experts to do it, and then they're going to have to be sufficiently informed to judge the performance of the experts who are drawing the lines. It'll be interesting.
It will be interesting. The clerks themselves do have a role in redistricting at the local level and a stake in reducing political gerrymandering. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Linda?
The part that I'll touch on is where the clerk and the treasurer and the prosecuting attorney all get together, and we have our role in the redistricting as far as the county commissioners go, and also our state legislators. Now, the state legislators are going to be
representatives,
I'm sorry, will be talked about in that proposal. So it'll be interesting to see how this all pans out when the voters vote. So, or if it even, because right now it's not even on the ballot yet, correct? Right. So we're still waiting
again,
for some of that.
And again, it's presumed that this will make voting more competitive, which is something we'd all like, but only if voters adhere to partisan divisions, number one, and only if the parties are successful in getting their constituency to the polls. If there are too many loose cannons out there, obviously that, that sort of folds as a criteria. But a lot of people didn't vote in the last election. Many voted independently of what might have been practiced or predicted. What does that do to the reform model, do you think? People are starting to vote off books, or, you know, they're not voting the way it's predicted they would vote.
Well, it's harder, I think, the pollsters. Well, I have to qualify that
a
bit, because the pollsters were actually pretty close in predicting how the last vote was coming out. If you look at the polls that were taken just prior to the election, they were polling right up until the end. And part of the problem that candidate Clinton had was she quit polling too early and wound up coming up short some places where they could have delegated some more of their resources. But now we get into more election campaigning issues.
Exactly.
But it's hard to predict exactly how somebody's going to vote. And people do not have as solid voter identifications, I think, as they once did. And they kind of move from one to the other, especially those people who call themselves independents. They are the ones that can move a little bit one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And so many elections recently are decided by just a percentage point or two, or even less, that just a small fluctuation can throw it one way or the other.
It's not so much that they are independents, as some people are Democrats and some people are Republicans. It's that they vote independently. And there's a long history of this in labor, you know, voting off book, so to speak, or off party. We talked a little bit about, we mentioned the Russian thing and how they weren't able to hack any ballot boxes. But some observe that the online campaign shows that social media is so ingrained in some people's lives that they can easily, and in many cases willingly, be misled, depending on what the message is that they see. And this is a case of media is the message. So it's easy to disrupt election campaigns by using social media, simply as social media is designed to be used. You don't have to change anything about it. Any observations on that?
Well, I think this has really come to the fore in recent days with regard to Cambridge Analytica, which is this British firm that was hired, using Facebook and got Facebook information and then used it to target voters for campaign purposes.
And information on millions.
And information on, I think, 5 million people. Mm-hmm. Now, this gets into yet another issue, and that is, did Cambridge Analytica influence on the campaigns throw the election one way or the other? I think when you look at the campaign, you shouldn't look for one reason as to why Clinton won or Clinton lost and Trump won. And the reason I think is it's kind of like a basketball game in which the game was lost by 1 point. When the coach goes back and looks at the films from the game, they don't say who dropped the ball in the last minute. They look at the whole game and they say what were the contributing factors that made it so close. And I think that's the key thing that we need to look at. Having said all of that and talking about Russian involvement, I think there was very little evidence there was Russian involvement in manipulating the actual vote, in terms of getting into the voting booth and doing that sort of thing. But it would be almost impossible to say yes or no that they didn't have an influence on opinion.
Yeah, they sowed a lot of
discontent. And then it's just a very narrow thing, if it's a fraction of a percentage point, whether that was important. But there are other things,
too. And
there
are other things that could influence opinion. For example, while obscured by all the internet shenanigans over the past year, considerable attention had been given previously to polls and polling data generated by various people, some partisan, some not, and some apparently that looked partisan even after they weren't. It proved so alarmingly wrong in the 2016 elections. I think NPR had Clinton winning by 85% at one point.
Or 85% maybe.
You know, that kind of thing. It was like, some of these poll numbers just didn't seem reasonable, and people obviously didn't vote that way.
You know, so, when you use the term partisan polling, it's interesting because partisan polling is very good, but you never see the partisan polls.
Yeah.
Because it's the
partisan polling is the way you ask the question.
Yeah, well, and partisans pay for polls, but they want them to be accurate. So the Republicans aren't paying for pollsters millions of dollars to have them pat them on the back. They want to hear what the people are really saying, but they don't release those polls to the public.
Yeah.
It's the public polls that would be driven by partisan incentive, I think, that you may have been referring to.
And there are some bipartisan polls that seem to be fairly reliable with good sample size, not anything too large or too small.
I think,
small.
You know, you have the Gallup
Rasmussen
and all of these.
Poll,
and, yeah.
You know,
and you
the
have
Gallup
the,
poll.
The Wall Street Journal Time poll and all that. And they're reasonable.
Polls.
They're not being distorted for political reasons. One other thing, there's things called, there's polling and then there's push polling. And some push polling is when you get a telephone call and they're pushing, the question is really not getting your opinion, it's trying to push you in a particular direction. You know, you want to vote for candidate X who believes in...
Or special pleading one result.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, that's something that's very common.
Yeah.
The problem with this, I think, it goes back to whether or not people think votes matter. Someone watching the networks and cable news might be dissuaded from voting at all based on a chain of projections reported. People become discouraged that their vote might be pointless if they've already called a state before they even gotten to the polls. Again, big data here can do more harm than good. How do you report on elections? How you report on elections can actually affect the outcome is, you know, is at least a good question there.
Well, they have closed. So, they have requirements now that they close the. They don't release the polls and project. They don't release the projections until after the polls have closed.
Okay, is that the solution?
Well, in a way, it's better than if you release the projections and people are still going to the polls, because why bother going?
Yeah.
So I think
that's
important.
But somebody's giving you a color glossy, you know, thing there. And it's got all these icons on it and everything. They're all marshaled over to one side or the other. You know, you haven't closed the polls yet, but it's almost a prediction already because they've been adding to it for the entire program.
Well, CNN, for example, they have their magic wall or whatever that they're moving stuff around. But they don't call a state until after the polls have closed in that state. Now, they may have their talking heads there who are all, you know, saying it's all going for Hillary or it's all going for Trump. And then as they get closer to what's really happening.
I think we have to call it there for time.
Yeah. Hey.
This has been part two of a program called Making Votes Matter with Marquette County Clerk Linda Talsma, Marquette City Clerk Chris Hazarus, and Northern Michigan University Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Administration, Robert Kulishek. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Harden Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.